It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if there's special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom versus force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed. Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And go over to Facebook and give us a like. And sign up for our weekly newsletter. There's all kinds of great information there. We have our upcoming guests, as well as these fabulous op-eds from a variety of authors, and also our new Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast. So be sure and sign up for our newsletter on that. It is Independence Week, and we've got just amazing shows planned for you this week. Before we jump into everything, I always like to say thank you to this great team that I get to work with. That's producer Steve, Keith, Zach, Patty, and Charlie. I got everybody this morning. That's everybody, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, that's okay. It. That's us.
Yeah, so how are you doing? It's a great week. It's so wonderful. This is one of my favorite holidays, is the 4th of July.
Yeah, I've always been drawn to it for a variety of reasons, but the older I get, the more I appreciate the history of our country and all that it took to bring it about. I have a great appreciation for it, and you have really put together some great stuff for this week.
Well, and we look at these issues as freedom versus force, force versus freedom. Socialism ultimately comes down to force. And King George was using all kinds of force with the colonists. And that is why they finally said, we have to declare our freedom, our independence. And that is what we're celebrating this week. Today's show, though, we're going to be talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. And he was a Frenchman, and we'll be talking about him with Joshua Dunn. Joshua Dunn is a professor of constitutional law and political theory at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. And so it's going to be a really fascinating conversation. And de Tocqueville, he lived from 1805 to 1859. He was a French aristocrat, diplomat, political scientist, and historian. He is best known for his works, Democracy in America and the Old Regime of the Revolution. And so he went throughout the we weren't the colonies anymore, the states, and just was observing what was happening in America. And there is this quote that I think many of us have heard. This is de Tocqueville. He says, I sought for the greatness and genius of America in her commodious harbors and her ample rivers, and it was not there. In her fertile fields and boundless forests, and it was not there. In her rich mines and her vast world commerce, and it was not there. In her democratic Congress and her matchless Constitution, and it was not there. Not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because she is good, and if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great. Wow, what do you think of that?
You almost want to say amen after that. Well, and the power of that whole quote is in that very last portion there about America is great because it's good, and if it ceases to be good, it will cease to be great. And, you watch what's going on all around us every day, and you think, is this coming about?
I'm encouraged. I mean, we've gone through times before. Mankind seems like we have to tussle with these issues with each generation. Although what's happening in America right now is anarchy. And another one of de Tocqueville's quotes, this is from Democracy in America. He said, the revolution of the United States was the result of a mature and reflecting preference for freedom, and not a vague or ill-defined craving for independence. It contracted no alliance with the turbulent passions of anarchy, but its course was marked by a love of order and law. I mean, that is just so poignant for right now.
It is, and I hate to be alarmist. I hate to be the naysayer. When you talk about our past and we have faced great challenges in the past, yes, we absolutely have. again, it's in our history. But what seems to be happening right now is coming from within, and that's maybe why it frightens me so much.
Well, it's been percolating underneath the surface for quite some time. I think that we have real clarity now, though, Steve. Those that had the narrative of inclusion and tolerance, peace, love, they say that, but they don't really mean it. You know, America has had the name the Great Melting Pot, but these people instead want to put everything in different groups. Instead of a melting pot, they want it to be a salad with all these different groups. And if that is the case, it will be very difficult for the American idea to continue on. So we really have this big battle of ideas that's going on right now, Steve, in our country, the battle of law and order and prosperity and lifting everybody up. The other option we're seeing, and that is chaos and its destruction and tearing people down. Yeah, they're for equality, but they'll tear everybody down. They think that they'll be the elites, and it'll be the elites and everybody else. And so we have this big battle of ideas that's occurring right now in America.
Well, maybe you just hit on the piece of it that I can't seem to figure out is the elitism that makes it all work for them, because I can't go down that path. I can't see that we're going to be overseen by these elites, and yet it's here. I just can't cope with it.
Well, and that is why we do this show, Steve, and that's why it's so important, my friends, that we keep our brains around these important issues. And so the shows that we have planned this week will help. Again, help you think about the Declaration of Independence. You know, what was going on at that time, and then also tomorrow we'll talk about Gettysburg, because the Battle of Gettysburg was fought July 1 through July 3, and so again, a very defining time in our country. And the people don't realize slavery was prevalent throughout the world for generations. It's absolutely astonishing that this little country, based on this idea of the declaration that all men are created equal with these rights from God of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, it was just, two and a half generations later that we fought a war on that. So we'll talk about that tomorrow, but there's just great shows that we have planned for everybody this week.
One more thought about the elitism, now that I think about it. We're talking about our independence, independence from a monarchy. And what is a monarchy but probably the ultimate form of it, elitism?
Yeah,
the king was elite.
Yeah, there was just one real elite. Of course, all the people around him as well, and they made the decisions for everybody else. So let's go to break, because when we come back, we'll be talking with Joshua Dunn. He is a professor of constitutional law and political theory at the University of Colorado down in Colorado Springs. But what a fun time to just go sit out on the deck at one of the Hooters restaurants sometime this week. They have 5 locations: Loveland, Westminster, Aurora, Lone Tree, and Colorado Springs. They now have dine-in, to-go, delivery, and curbside service. Happy hour is Monday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. So that would be a fun thing to get to do sometime this week. So be sure and go to order.hooters.com for more information. You can go to my website, kimmunson.com. All my sponsors are there. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back with Joshua Dunn.
Karen Levine has over 30 years in the real estate industry. The reaction to the COVID-19 Wuhan virus is presenting unprecedented and unpredictable opportunities and challenges in buying or selling your home. That is why you need to work with award-winning realtor Karen Levine. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516. Karen's expertise will help guide you through this crazy real estate market. Call Karen Levine at 303-877-7516 today.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
This is my country, land of my birth.
Welcome back to to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Go over to Facebook and give us a like. And at the website, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. So we'll keep you apprised of all the upcoming guests, our op-eds, our Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast. And so be sure and check that out. I am thrilled today, though. You know, we are getting ready to celebrate Independence Day on the 4th. And so this is a very special week. We're talking about America's founding. Of course, tomorrow, July 1, that is the beginning of the Battle of Gettysburg. So we'll chat about that. So it's a very important week in the history of America. And I'm thrilled to have on the line with me Professor Joshua Dunn. He teaches at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, and he teaches constitutional law and political theory. Joshua Dunn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be with you.
Our subject for today is Alexis de Tocqueville, and he was a French aristocrat, a diplomat, a political scientist, and historian, and he's best known for his works Democracy in America and The Old Regime of the Revolution. In both, he analyzed the improved living standards and social conditions of individuals, as well as their relationship to the market and state in Western societies. Democracy in America was published after Tocqueville's travels in the United States and is today considered an early work of sociology and political science. And Tocqueville was born in 1805. He died at the young age of 53 in 1859. So Joshua Dunn, for somebody that doesn't really know de Tocqueville, just knows that he had a great appreciation for America, where should we start?
Well, obviously his book, Democracy in America, but I think the thing that people need to know primarily about Alexis de Tocqueville was that this book, Democracy in America, which in my view is the best book on democracy and the best book on America ever written, is that the subject really of the book is not democracy or America, but really liberty, or how to maintain liberty in a democratic age. Tocqueville was deeply concerned with preserving a free society. And so most of his thoughts in Democracy in America are trying to figure out what can America teach the rest of the world about this new social condition, which was really sweeping the Western world, this democratic age, which he saw coming. How can you actually preserve liberty in this new time of equality?
Well, you know, you hear the word democracy many times. We'll have politicians, attorneys, judges, you know, people talk about the democracy. We need to preserve our democracy. But democracy is actually a little different than the constitutional republic that we have. And democracy can be dangerous because you can get into the tyranny of the mob.
Yes, and that was one of Tocqueville's primary concerns. He, better than anyone else, recognized and explained the extraordinary power of public opinion in a democratic age. Now, on this question of democracy versus a republic, the American founders would often refer to a democratic republic or a republic with democratic elements. And so I'm not certain it's terribly helpful to say that Tocqueville didn't understand what he was describing in America. He certainly was well aware of America's political institutions and the type of regime that the founders tried to construct. But what he recognized was there's a deep spirit of equality behind the American experiment. And in some ways, that's what he means by democracy, this egalitarian spirit, which also this political equality, which he sees at the core of the American experiment, also leads to a good deal of social equality. And then that has extraordinary effects on us, but then it also does create the potential for this tyranny of the majority.
And now the French Revolution was a totally different revolution than the America's Revolution. And so what, did Tocqueville see that? I mean, did he have commentary on that?
Oh, certainly. So, you know, his book, The Old Regime and the French Revolution, was really diagnosing what the French Revolution was. And in it, he argues that the French Revolution was really the culmination of a centuries-long process of centralization of power. It's also important to note that Tocqueville's grandparents were murdered during the French Revolution, during the Reign of Terror. His own parents barely escaped with their lives. So we almost didn't have Alexis de Tocqueville because of the French Revolution. The fact that he was an aristocrat deeply matters as well, because on the European continent, for aristocrats, democracy meant the French Revolution, which was this mob rule and this terror. It was the most democratic moment Europe had experienced. And so Tocqueville was certainly fully aware of these dangerous tendencies. However, he also thought that there was, even though he was an aristocrat, he thought that there was something preferable about an egalitarian society or democratic society. He actually said you can see God's finger moving through history, making the nations of the world more democratic. And what he meant by that was that there was something fundamentally unjust about an aristocratic society, which is that where you're born is where you die, regardless of your talents and ambitions, where there's something about, at least in the American context, something preferable, where you can make something of yourself. That if you do have talent, ambition, you're willing to work hard, you can rise in society, where you can't do that in an aristocratic one.
Well, and, you know, it seems like we see some of the connections to the French Revolution now in America with tearing down things and saying that, you know, our quote unquote, our old ideas are bad. And I see some kind of correlation in that. What's your thoughts on that, Joshua?
Well, certainly you do see this impulse, this spirit, and there are many people who have made these connections, and I think that some of them are, that they're correct to make some of these connections. Unfortunately, we haven't gotten to the Reign of Terror. But there is this impulse sometimes to try and destroy everything from the past, and you see that taken to its complete end in the French Revolution. You know, they started with year one, right? They're remaking everything. There's going to be a new calendar, it's going to be the Church of Reason, and all the old institutions were going to be destroyed, and you see where that got people. It got them to the Reign of Terror. And once again, Tocqueville was certainly aware of this and the importance of trying to preserve institutions that also help preserve liberty and expand liberty.
You know, I really think, Josh, that, you know, we have big questions all the time is are we going to try to work towards, you know, those ideas, the idea of liberty, which is the responsible exercise of freedom. You know, do we work towards those ideals and have conversations about that, you know, and which is unleashed all kinds of creativity and innovation? I mean, the fact that we have had this big, vibrant middle class of everyday people that have been able to go out and, as you said, make something of themselves, you know, I think is inherent up on the American idea. And I think that's probably some of the things that Tocqueville was recognizing relatively early on.
Yes. What he saw in America was this incredibly prosperous nation. And the world had never seen such an egalitarian society where you had such prosperity so widely spread and such political equality such widely spread. And that was despite what he called America's social blemishes. I mean, he certainly recognized the evil of slavery and had a very powerful indictment of slavery in democracy in America. What he recognizes that this is what was happening in America, and then this equality was just going to be more and more widely spread. There's going to be opportunity that was going to be created by this. But he also recognized something. There's this interesting chapter in Democracy in America where he says, you know, why the Americans are so restive or restless in the middle of their well-being, in the midst of their well-being, their prosperity. So even in the middle of this extraordinary prosperity, people still show deep dissatisfaction, which then can lead to some of the things I think that we're witnessing today.
Did he come up with an answer of why there was that dissatisfaction?
Yeah, so what he argues is that in a democracy compared to, say, an aristocracy, so in an aristocracy, class differences are just considered the nature of things. So people don't question them. That's just the way the world operates. And so they don't think about them all that much. But in a democratic age, equality becomes the standard. And so then people start recognizing any instance of inequality even more. And so this is actually what he says. He says, when the when inequality is the common law of society, the strongest inequalities do not strike the eye. When everything is nearly on a level, the least of them wounded. That is why the desire for equality always becomes more insatiable as equality is greater. So actually, as you get equality, you start to desire even more equality. And so then any deviation from this is considered just immoral or a violation of the order of society that has to be obliterated really at any cost. And so that's what then leads to these outbursts where people start tearing down anything that would be any indication of this absence of pure and perfect equality.
So, Josh, what I'm hearing here is that really there can be kind of two definitions of equality. And so when initially I think the founders and the American idea talked about equality, it was the equality that all men are created equal and that they have these rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which I think is a beautiful, noble equality. The other equality that is not a good one, and that is the equality that comes out of envy, out of being envious of what somebody else might have and wanting to make that equal. And then that gets into picking winners and losers, taking things via force. And what's your thoughts on that?
Yes. So that's one of the things that Tocqueville also recognized and argued is that this political equality in our rights, naturally leads to a good deal of social equality. And then what happens as the social equality grows because of the political equality, people are actually willing to forfeit the political equality to attack, to undermine the political equality in order to try and achieve more social equality. But then, of course, that becomes a threat to your liberty. And that's the thing that he was most concerned about preserving, was preserving the natural rights and liberties that we have as human beings. And so this is the danger, that this our desire for political equality becomes perverted into a desire for complete social equality, which can only come at the expense of our freedom.
Okay. And would you say that complete social equality, another name for that would be socialism?
Yes, but I think there's something even more to it than that. So, for instance, I think you can see some of the impulses that people have even go beyond what you saw in the worst forms of communist and socialist tyranny in the 20th century. There's something else that even seems to be at work, but that is certainly part of it. Where any outcome that is not completely equal is considered inherently illegitimate. Of course, the irony is that when you surrender to that impulse, is that you actually end up creating a worse form of inequality than you already had before. I mean, after all, you think about the Soviet Union or any other communist regime around the world today, what you see is not social equality, even though that's the promise. You actually see even greater social inequality. You know, the party members are grossly unequal to everyone else. That is, the people that are in power and are given the obligation or entrusted to create the social equality are far different than everywhere else.
It is astounding. So let's go to break. This is Kim Munson. I am talking with Joshua Dunn. He is a professor down at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. We'll be right back. Hey, before we go to break, Jason McBride, Presidential Wealth Management. It is Independence Week. And what's going on over in your world?
Well, you know, there's always interesting things going on in my world, Kim. I was actually thinking about last week when I came to the three punches to knock out democratic socialism, mm-hmm. and there was a fellow there named Leon that I hadn't seen him since we went to one of the Federalist Papers like a year ago, and it was great to see Leon again.
Uh-huh.
He's a great fellow. And we got to talking about how you know, the news is just coming so fast and furious, and they change the subject so quick that it just blows your mind, mm-hmm. spins your head. He and I were joking that we don't even have time to hear something these leftists have done and get mad about it before they've done something else we're mad about. So we were having a pretty good laugh about that. But it reminded me of this quote, which I think is interesting. It's from Albert J. Nock, N-O-C-K. He's a libertarian writer and social theorist.
Okay.
And he said, "The mind is like the stomach. It's not how much you put into it that counts, but how much it digests. If you try to feed it with a shovel, you get bad results."
True that. Now, I never thought I'd kind of put that whole thing together, but that's a pretty good quote, Jason McGray.
Well, I think it is because, you know, I find myself these days, you know, forgetting about something that I thought was very, very important because I've had so much other stuff crammed into it. And I think that is a thing of modern times where we're getting bombed with so much information on a daily basis from so many different places. I mean, you've got your TV, the radio, your phone. It's almost like you can't escape it. And I remember this information overload in our industry being discussed, you know, 10 to 12 years ago when you started getting the CNBC and all these financial channels that were just bombarding people with information about the stock market, their investments, minute by minute by minute. Sometimes I think with investing, it's better to shut that out and just forget about it for a while because you can drive yourself crazy on a daily basis, which can lead to making bad emotional decisions.
Right. You know, typically, I mean, really with almost anything, when you have emotion going on, you don't make good decisions. And, you know, we see that also with what's happening with this tearing down our history, our statues. It's all emotion. And you can see we just don't make good decisions when we're acting on emotion. So, you know, I think, Jason, we're all different, but to come up with a plan, revisit it periodically, and then just stay disciplined and live your life. I think that's good advice.
Well, I think that's smart, and if you can, I know it's hard to shut off your emotion, and you can't, but you learn to manage it and live with it. And I would say in investing, one of the things is don't be too tough on yourself and expect perfection, because you're never going to get it.
Never going to get it.
I mean, if you can do okay, you know, make a decent return, I think that's a smart thing. But certainly don't expect perfection, because it's probably never going to happen.
Never going to happen, that's for sure. So Jason McBride, thank you so much. The number over there is 303-694-1600, 303-694-1600 at Presidential Wealth Management. Jason, thanks so much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Kim.
Recently, rates in the mortgage market have hit near record lows. Lorne Levy with Polygon Financial notes that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has created potential opportunities to refinance your mortgage that could save you thousands of dollars. And for those senior listeners who may be looking for another source of income, exploring a reverse mortgage with Lorne Levy may be a solution. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lorne Levy has the experience to answer your questions. Call Lorne Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup today.
Now more than ever, it is important to have independent voices bringing truth and clarity to the issues facing us, our families, our communities, our state, our nation, and our world. The Kim Munson Show is one of those important voices. Kim is a truly independent entrepreneur. She purchases her broadcast time, which gives her total freedom in production of the show and scheduling of guests. If you'd like to support The Kim Munson Show, go to her website, Kim Munson, MONSON.com, and click on the contribute button under Kim's picture. Kim greatly appreciates your help and support.
Welcome back to The Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. You can sign up for our weekly email newsletters there, and you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com as well. And be sure and go over to Facebook and give us a like also. Really thrilled to have on the line with me Professor Joshua Dunn. He teaches at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, and he teaches constitutional law and political theory. And today we're talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. And Tocqueville had just this deep appreciation for the American idea, but he really thought about all the different social constructs. And you mentioned as we were talking during break that he felt that public opinion was very important. And we see that play out all the time right now. Go ahead and comment on that, Josh.
Certainly. So Tocqueville, I think, has the best explanation for why public opinion is so powerful in a democracy. And he gives three reasons for this. First reason is the principle of legislative supremacy. That is, in a democracy, the legislature is the primary lawmaking institution. And legislatures operate according to the principle of majority rule. So the side that has the most votes wins, typically. And Tocqueville thinks that that reinforces the idea that the majority must be correct, that there's some repository of wisdom in what the majority thinks. And it even provides a kind of moral force, you would say, for public opinion. Now, there's a basic problem with this, which is that there's nothing necessary about public opinion to say that it's going to arrive at the truth versus some other method of trying to reason about a particular problem. After all, if I'm walking down the street and 10 robbers jump out of the bushes and say that they're going to take all my money, and I tell them, well, that's wrong, right? That violates the law or something, that's immoral, and then they go back behind the bushes and they talk about it and they come back out and they say, hey, well, we voted on it, and 7 of us still say we need to steal your money, right? That doesn't mean that it's morally correct, right? But nevertheless, this is nurtured through this idea of legislative supremacy and the principle of majority rule that's embedded in legislative supremacy.
At our founding, you know, as they deliberated this, they deliberated things. I mean, they eventually got to majority rule as well, but it seemed like maybe today we have public opinion or majority rule, but without a lot of deliberation. I think voices might be getting shut down. Does that make any sense to you at all, Josh?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, all you have to do is get on Twitter and you see this. I would just say Tocqueville would not be surprised at all by these Twitter mobs and the cancel culture that we see. He, in fact, describes something very similar. But what he says, again, is that public opinion has this almost religious authority. And so if you transgress, right, violate, commit some kind of heresy against what the public thinks, basically you're going to be driven out of society. That's what's going to happen to you. And that really comes from these two other factors that feed into the power of public opinion. Equality itself, that is, that we have this so much social equality, and then also something that he calls individualism or privatism. So what happens is that because we're all basically equal in a democracy, we have this incredible compression of experiences in a democracy. Even though you can say that we have these extraordinarily wealthy people, you know, the Jeff Bezoses of the world and Bill Gates and those things, but you compare their experiences to, say, the experience of, say, a lord versus your common serf, you know, 700 years ago. There's this shocking compression of life in this modern age. And so that reinforces the idea, Tocqueville thinks, that no single person's opinion is better than anyone else's, right? We just don't think that anyone else's opinion is better than yours. But then everyone knows that we have to have some source of authority to resolve conflicts and disputes. And so what we do in our minds is we think, well, because everyone has the same capacity to reason, the balance of reason must be on the side of the majority. So we just surrender to public opinion.
But now I think that may be a false premise that at least what I'm hearing is that all opinions have the same weight. Some people don't think about their opinions as much. Some people are just totally on emotion. So what would Tocqueville say about that?
Oh, yeah. He doesn't say that this is correct, right? Public opinion can very easily be wrong. But he thinks that this is what goes on in the minds of people. They think, well, no single person's opinion is better than anyone else.
So let's
add up what everyone thinks. And you can see the power of this, right, if you just watch one of those political debate shows and, get a conservative and a liberal that's shouting at each other. And there's one thing that always stops the debate, which is that when one person presents an opinion poll and says, well, 70% of Americans disagree with you. Now, there's one thing that the other side never says. Well, 70% of Americans are wrong. Right? I mean, do you ever hear anyone say that? But, of course, the public can be deeply wrong. And in fact, we know this. There's all sorts of research from political scientists showing that on many very important questions, the public is just uninformed. That doesn't mean people are stupid. It's that they're what are called they're rationally ignorant. That is, they got busy lives. They've got kids. They've got jobs. And so they can't follow every single political issue. But there's, for the past 80 years, we've been accumulating, 70 years or so, we've been accumulating research just showing that on many important questions, the public really doesn't know. So it is irrational to actually just submit to public opinion.
That is really fascinating. So what you're saying is Tocqueville, he's really analyzing public opinion. And it seems like he's spot on for what is happening today. I mean, we've morphed into, though, I was talking to somebody just the other day saying there is so much information coming that, it's very difficult to discern, what is true, what isn't. And so I think that we're probably on steroids with this move towards public opinion. And of course, we had, used to be just three networks, and now we have, mm-hmm. All these different places where people can get news sources. What do you think Tocqueville would say about all this?
Yeah, so I think he would say that there are advantages and disadvantages of our current situation compared to our past situation. Right? As you mentioned, it used to be that there are basically four news outlets that mattered. The NBC, ABC, CBS, and the New York Times.
Okay.
Those were really all that mattered. They kind of drove the national news cycle. And today, right, the internet and cable news has really changed that. And so in some ways that's healthy. So in some ways that is very healthy. So you think about Brian Williams, when he fabricated this story about his bravery, right, during the Iraq War, right?
Mm-hmm.
Saying he was flying on this helicopter and they came under attack and all of that. And, some guy who was actually part of the convoy got on some, I think it was Facebook or somewhere and said, hey, I was part of that, and that didn't happen, right? Or you think about Dan Rather, fabricating that story or publicizing that fabricated story about George Bush in the 2004 election. And some guy who happened to be an expert on typeface said, well, no one could have actually produced that letter in 1970 or whenever it was. And that got produced on a blog, right? So in some ways, that the fact that these sources can, you have information that can come from the periphery to the center much more easily, it is very, very healthy. But there's no doubt, right, that there are problems associated with this. We can isolate ourselves into our political cocoons, and then we can be subjected to this kind of these outrage mobs, social justice mobs that can occur on social media. You think about the kids from the Catholic school last year, where everyone just piled on without knowing the full information. So that's obviously a significant danger.
Well, most definitely. And what do you think Tocqueville would say to us? What should we do about it?
Yeah. So this is where Tocqueville, I think, has timeless advice for us. And this is gonna it's gonna matter for other dangers that he sees in democracy. But there are some very important principles for Tocqueville. First is that he wants decentralization of power, as much as possible. He recognizes that some things must be handled at the national level. But it's at the local level, he thinks, that you're drawn out of your private existence, and then you're forced to interact with other real human beings, which is important for actually mitigating the power of public opinion, because now you're talking to other people and you're discussing things. It also combats the kind of fatalistic tendency that we have in democracy, which is that individuals don't matter. It's only these mass social movements. So he wants decentralization of power. But then the other thing that he wants is he thinks that democracies can't survive without what he calls the art of association. And today we would call that social capital or something like that, which the kind of rough and ready definition would be the ability of citizens to solve problems without government assistance.
What a novel idea.
Exactly, right? So you need to be engaged with groups that teach you this art of association. So for Tocqueville, that would be things like religious groups, so churches, synagogues. It would also be civic associations, but even local governments themselves could perform this function. Interest groups, you would say, can also help perform this function. So in other words, citizens need to be engaged, and by becoming engaged with other people, you can once again develop your own deliberative habits so that you aren't just going to be a victim of public opinion.
That is very, very wise. Josh, let's go to break. This is Kim Munson. I am talking with University of Colorado at Colorado Springs Professor Joshua Dunn. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back.
Predovich & Company understands that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has individuals and businesses scratching their heads with a variety of bookkeeping, tax planning, and accounting questions. Predovich & Company knows that you need trusted professionals to help you navigate these choppy waters. Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich & Company. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich & Company can help clients anywhere in the United States. Call Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 to organize your personal and business finances. Call 303-791-3000 today.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
God bless America.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Be sure and sign up for our weekly newsletter. We give and get you all kinds of great information, our upcoming guests, our new Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcasts, our op-eds, and go over to Facebook and give us a like as well. Thrilled to have on the line with me. What an amazing conversation. This is Professor Joshua Dunn. He teaches constitutional law and political theory at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. And we're talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. And let's talk about, you know, we're just visiting during break, that Tocqueville felt that there was a great threat to liberty. And what is that, Joshua?
So we call it soft despotism. What Tocqueville said is that what democracy had to fear most was not, at least initially, a traditional form of despotism, but a milder or softer form, something that we call soft despotism. At the beginning of democracy in America, he said there was something I couldn't figure out that was really bothering me about democracy, and then it finally came to him. And so if anyone goes and reads Tocqueville, this comes at the end of Volume 2 of Tocqueville's Democracy in America, Book 4, Volume 2. And essentially, you could summarize soft despotism as when people vote away their freedom for security. And that's his primary fear. He thinks that in a democracy, people are going to be isolated. They're going to feel weak. They're going to feel vulnerable. And so they'll turn their eyes to the only institution capable of protecting them, which is the central government. And so then they voluntarily relinquish their freedom. And so he calls it a soft despotism because you did it to yourself, so you think it's good for you. And it ends up being, at least initially, a milder form of despotism.
Boy, it seems to me like the social theorists that are working in America today, I mean, I'm just thinking of this whole COVID-19 Wuhan virus reaction disruption, and made the comment that because people were afraid, they were constantly made afraid, public opinion. I mean, you know, when you're watching television along the side, used to be, you know, the sports scores, and then it's death tolls. I mean, it scares people a lot. And it seems like we've just kind of thrown a bunch of our civil liberties into the laps of different politicians and bureaucrats and interested parties. What's your thoughts on that, Josh?
Exactly. That's exactly what he fears, is that anytime people feel insecure, that they're going to willingly relinquish many of their rights in order to feel protected and to feel safe. Now, he would deny that there might be some circumstances when there might be more need of government authority in order to control a crisis or something like that. But you always have to be aware that this can go too far and easily go too far. So what he's talking about is people wanting to essentially be taken financially taken care of by the state. So what he was predicting was the rise of the welfare state. But the psychological phenomenon that he's talking about applies to all sorts of circumstances. It can apply to what people are thinking right now or were thinking 2 months ago with COVID. It applied after 9/11 when people felt very vulnerable. I'm certain there are a lot of Americans who would have, you know, been very willing to carve out significant sections of the Bill of Rights in order to just feel safe and secure. So that's really that's what he's describing. It applies to many different circumstances.
You know, it's so interesting you would mention that, because I consider myself a freedom girl, a liberty girl, the responsible exercise of freedom. And I remember after 9/11, you know, hearing about the Patriot Act, and I'm thinking to myself, boy, I see some real challenges with that. You know, and I was tussling with that in my brain, but it's like, oh, okay, if it's going to make us safe, okay. Well, then we look back and, you know, it's been around now forever. It's morphed into other things. And so I can see how each of us, I don't want to just mention other people, you know, I've done it myself. It's like, okay, if we're going to be more safe. And then I realized looking back that I don't think it was the best choice at the time.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's very easy to do it. We all can fall into it. It's not a phenomenon of one side or the other. He thinks that these forces that are sort of shaping the way we think into democracy affect all of us. And so we all need to be aware of them. And if you're actually going to try and resist them, you have to make yourself aware of them. I think one way of viewing Tocqueville is he's like a physician. He's diagnosing the diseases that democracy is prone to contracting. And what he's trying to tell you is that you need to take some preventative measures in order to avoid contracting these diseases. And one of those is simply just to be aware of this constant temptation in all of our minds to vote away freedom for security, to feel safe at the expense of our liberty.
So another question, we've got probably about 6 minutes or so, is I was at a meeting, and now I can't remember, there were three different ways that they said people can look at their relationship with I guess in the social construct, and that those that may be over more on the left look at life as the oppressed and the oppressor. So more that victim thing. I can't remember what the middle one was. And then those more to the right is, you know, law, order, you know, not chaos. What would you say about that, Josh?
Certainly, I think there's some truth to that. And yeah, I think there's people who've done some really interesting work on this. The person you're thinking of might have been Jonathan Haidt. You
know, yes, that's who it was.
NYU. Yeah, it's been really interesting work on this. And I think there is something to that. I do think on the left, some of what you see is kind of the residual effect of class-based analysis. I don't want to say it's just pure Marxism, but you see starting with Karl Marx, this emphasis on class analysis of society. And you can see how this would be very tempting in a democracy, given what Tocqueville has said, is, you know, people see achieve more equality, they desire it even more, and so that, you know, this Marxist idea that any kind of inequality is just a form of exploitation, so that people need to throw off their chains and all of that and revolt. I think that there is something to that, and I think that you see that in, at least in some elements of the left, and particularly on the far left. I mean, all you have to do is look at, you know, these many of the people who are, you know, writing graffiti on monuments. Often it's not that they're complaining about police brutality or mistreatment of African Americans. Instead, they're actually advocating for a Marxist society. You know, they really want a Marxist revolution. So it's still there.
And that's interesting, within the last few weeks that there had been, I think it was a statue, and I want to say it was in Seattle. My memory, I mean, there's so much going on, but that like a George Washington monument was destroyed and the Lenin monument was left standing. I just find that kind of ironic on that.
Oh, yeah. And it turned out the Lenin monument was on private property. But, of course, Lenin wasn't terribly enthusiastic about respecting property rights. So, you know, why should that matter?
It's a really interesting time. But this welfare state, we've got maybe about 4 minutes that, you know, that we've been moving towards. And a lot of it, I think, well, it happened back with FDR. The seeds were sown, I think, like with Social Security, and then moving on into Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, where people didn't necessarily have to work to receive money. But there's great danger, and we're seeing that really play out to where we are now. So, Josh, what's your thoughts on that?
Certainly. So I think that ultimately for Tocqueville, the biggest danger of this, because in order for the government to provide for you like that, you do have to turn over significant power to the government. And, you know, this might seem, like it's good for you. And, you know, Tocqueville wouldn't deny that charity and taking care of the vulnerable in society is an important thing to do. He would much prefer it be done at the local level and, through private charity. But he can understand why. But the problem that he sees primarily is that once you're in that position, is that if the government just moves on from providing for you financially to doing actually malicious and harmful things to you, you no longer have the resources to actually resist. So that is, once you're in a position of soft despotism, what he calls soft despotism, you're actually quite vulnerable to a real despotism. Because now you're extremely dependent, you're even more isolated than you were before. And so let's say that it's no longer about just providing, some kind of social safety net for people, but actually it's affirmatively harming your rights, violating your liberties in a very direct and egregious way. What can you do about it at that point? Is there any capacity to resist anymore? Tocqueville thinks that you probably don't have that capacity anymore once you're in that social position.
Boy, I tell you, I realize what I have some reading that I need to do, Joshua Dunn. This is absolutely fascinating. We've got just a little bit of time left. What would be, during this week that we are celebrating the independence of America from Britain, what is kind of the final thought that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Certainly. So I think that Tocqueville's primary advice to people in a democracy is to be engaged, to know your neighbors, to be involved in your community, that though it's that kind of activity that is the most important political activity, that there's no preserving freedom in a democracy without an engaged citizenry. So if you just retreat in your own private life more and more, you aren't going to develop the habits and virtues of a citizen. Those virtues that are necessary for preserving freedom. And most of the time, voting is important, but voting in some ways is the least significant part of political engagement. And political engagement can take many forms, and it primarily, for Tocqueville, should take the form of knowing the people around you, being engaged in your community, developing the habits of a free citizen.
Well, and to that point on voting, it is very important. It's to be taken very seriously. And so there is a responsibility to know the issues, to know the candidates. It is a civic responsibility. And if one doesn't take the time to engage like that, I think the responsible thing to do is to not vote. Because I think it's very important to be informed about what you're voting on. Josh, your final thought?
Exactly. And the only way you're going to do that, to be able to know how to vote intelligently, to be aware of the issues, is once again if you're engaged. If you just show up at the polls every 2 years or every 4 years without actually having been involved discussing the issues with your fellow citizens, once again you're just going to be manipulated by public opinion, and so it's going to be a kind of useless but even dangerous exercise because you won't be exercising your right to vote responsibly.
Well said. Joshua Dunn, thank you so much for joining me today and wish you a very happy Independence Day.
Thank you. It's wonderful being with you.
And our quote for today is de Tocqueville. He said, America is great because America is good. If America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. And so we need to make sure that we keep America great. Today, my friends, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. This is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America.